Thank you for coming today. We're going to start with our class on Hosea. We stopped last week with what's kind of the theme verse of Hosea in chapter 6, verse 6, where he talks about that God desires mercy, not sacrifice, an acknowledgement of the Lord rather than burnt offerings. And so we'll do a little bit of review, and then we'll pick up with some of the new material after that. We'll finish up chapter 6 and see if we can also get through chapter 7 this week. The concept that runs through the whole first half of the book of Hosea is emphasized again today. God has this statement in chapter 7, I long to redeem them. One of the things that Hosea emphasizes over and over again is God's longing to be with us, His desire for us to live in His presence, His desire to know us, His desire to show us His mercy and His compassion, that is so much more important to God than any of the things that we think are important, and even many of the things that we think are important when it comes to religion or when it comes to God. So we'll see that once more today. John is going to lead us in a time of prayer. Everyone must have known it was John leading the prayer since they quieted down in a big hurry when we got the class started. So everyone's looking forward to your leading us in a time of prayer, John. Amen. All right. The book of Hosea starts with a description of Hosea's own family, which he uses in a number of ways as a kind of a living symbol of his lessons that he's trying to teach. The problems that he had with his personal life and his family kind of came to a head on one occasion when his wife, who had been a prostitute and who was unfaithful to Hosea many times, not only went off into adultery again, but also got herself into such financial trouble that she was so much in debt that she was actually owned by another man. And when Hosea found out about this situation, being the righteous man he was, being a man of God, being someone who upholds high standards of truth and righteousness, what did he do about it?
Come on back.
That's right. He brought her back. He paid her debts himself. He brought her back home. He showed her his love all over again and his compassion all over again. It's an image of God in his longing to reach out to us, that again and again he does what Hosea says, he redeems the guilty. See, the righteous don't need to be redeemed. God wants to redeem the guilty. The healthy don't need a doctor, but the sick need a doctor. That's what Jesus Christ came to do. That's what God's ministry on this earth is all about. Well, last week we studied this part of Hosea that kind of climaxes in the verse that we have so often pointed out and that Jesus himself used to use to teach people to refocus their priorities. The concept of let us acknowledge the Lord, that God desires mercy, not sacrifice, and acknowledgement of God rather than offerings and rituals and so forth. The obstacle that he talks about at the beginning of chapter 5 is pride. Talks about how God's people can become so convinced of their own righteousness that they forget about their need. And they can become involved in things that maybe even start off as good, but get them down the wrong track because they forget how much they depend on God's grace at all times. They forget that everything good they have depends on God's grace. They take their blessings for granted, and they resent the things they don't have. They get one of the country's best basketball teams that wins almost all of its games, and they get depressed because it loses one game that everyone was making a fuss about. I'm sure none of you would do that, but there are people who do that. And what God has realized about Hosea's generation, he has this phrase, he says, they're not going to return to me. And that's not a rule that God is making. It's not a judgment. It's just an acknowledgement that, oh, these people are so caught up in their own righteousness that they're not going to return to me. And he has this phrase, they're even going to be devoured by their own festivals and religious observances. They're going to turn my presence into a curse to them instead of a blessing, because they're pursuing this worship and ministry, as it may be on the surface, but they're pursuing it with pride and self-sufficiency. And he has this theme of illness and healing that Jesus himself often talked about. The idea that they're sick, but they're, instead of seeking a doctor, they're seeking their own solutions. Now, he has this phrase, or this passage really, starting in chapter 5, verse 8, he talks about, sound the trumpet in Gibeah, the horn in Ramah, raise the battle cry in Beth Aven. That's because this little section of Hosea is set in a time of war. In 735 BC, the two halves of Israel, the northern kingdom of Ephraim and the southern kingdom of Judah, actually went to war with each other. They couldn't settle their differences peacefully, and they went to war with each other. And what made it worse was that instead of even limiting themselves to fighting each other, they both started trying to negotiate with foreign countries to come in on their side. They both tried to line up worldly mercenaries and worldly force, and they were resorting to all kind of political maneuvering and worldly deals to try to get these foreign countries to come in on their side. And so what Hosea does is he uses the background of this moronic war, and I apologize for the redundancy, he uses this background in order to point out that this war, as moronic and destructive as it is merely the inevitable outcome of things that have been going on in their hearts for a long time. And that's really the truth about the ills we see out there. They're symptoms. War and violence is ugly and evil, but it's only a symptom. It's a symptom of the things that lie underneath. The resentment, the irrational fear, the difficulty we have in relating to people who are not like us, it sometimes flares out in violence and war and other things like that. The crime that we see, the sins that we see out there, they're simply symptoms. They come from the fact that people misinterpret their own needs. They have a need for God that's not going fulfilled, and they try to fill that need in other ways. People have a need to be loved and to share love because they're made in God's image, and because they're not getting it, they turn to things like drunkenness or sexual immorality or other things that fill a temporary fleshly desire, but not the real desire. And we, as followers of Jesus, if we want to really help people, then we should try to understand what those things really are. And instead of attacking the symptoms, try to deal with their real need, which is the need to experience God's love and grace and mercy. Teach them to seek the right kind of doctor, is the imagery that Hosea uses. Because, as he talks about in chapter 6, he says, as surely as the sun rises, he will appear, he will come to us like the winter rains and the spring rains that water the earth. As surely as the sun rises, God desires to redeem. He desires to forgive. He desires to have mercy. Even though he may seem to have been the very one to have hurt you, he will restore us. And Hosea has a little phrase that's significant, especially from our point of view, in verse 2. After 2 days he will revive us, on the third day he will restore us. And of course that looks ahead to one of the great things in the gospel, the fulfillment of the cross and the resurrection. And so what he says is, let's just return to God. We don't have to try to defend or excuse all the things we've done. We don't have to try to make up for them. Just return to God. Accept God's mercy. And God is more interested in showing mercy than in holding you to arcane points of doctrine or ministry or methodology. God is more interested in you acknowledging Him, acknowledging His compassion, than in you doing things to show Him that you appreciate Him and that you want to obey Him. And you know, we certainly are aware that there are also scriptures that talk about will watch your life and doctrine closely, and you want to have a constructive ministry. And sometimes we view those as somehow being in antithesis or in competition with God's mercy and grace. Did you know that Adrian Monk has a cousin from Italy? Well, Adrian Monk's Italian cousin has a saying. He likes to say, "Ecco la cosa." Can you guess what that means? It's Italian for "here's the thing." So, "Ecco la cosa." Understanding that God desires mercy, not sacrifice, and that he desires acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings, that is sound doctrine. That is sound teaching about God. Understanding that God would rather forgive than punish, that is sound doctrine. That is sound teaching. That's what true sound doctrine is all about, not the things we do or the rules we make. True sound teaching about God goes back to God's own character, because everything else depends on that. And when we forget that that's the foundation of sound doctrine, that's when we get into these idiotic disputes about things, about methodology and practice, that really lead us away from God's presence instead of into God's presence. That's the foundation of true ministry. Truly ministering to someone, literally the word minister means to serve, means to serve. Understanding that that's God's nature is the foundation of true ministry. Understanding mercy and grace is not antithetical to doctrine and ministry. It's true doctrine and ministry. A lot of things we call doctrine is really not doctrine at all. It's just fussiness. A lot of things that we call ministry is not ministry at all. It's just self-righteousness. True doctrine and true ministry are always based on God's unlimited capacity for mercy and grace and forgiveness, and his incredible desire to love us and be with us no matter what. And that's very much what Hosea is going to focus on in this succeeding passage, which makes sense because he's just pointed out in verse 6 how much he desires mercy, not sacrifice. And it comes back again to God's dilemma that he always has, and that Hosea does such a powerful job of bringing out, how God always is faced with his own tremendous desire to know us, but our tremendous capacity to reject his grace, to do foolish things, to sin and to hurt each other. And one of the themes of the book of Hosea is, how does God deal with that? How does God come up with a way of responding to those seemingly irreconcilable facts? And of course, ultimately, those were reconciled through the cross. God himself died on the cross to pay the price for our sins so that he could forgive us. But for now, let's take a look at Hosea chapter 6. We're going to finish chapter 6 and read the first couple verses of chapter 7 here. Phil, this passage is for you, starting in chapter 6, verse 7. Could you go through the first part of verse 11, just the first half of it, and then Peggy, would you pick up in the middle of verse 11 and go through chapter 7, verse 2.
My God, if they have broken the covenant, they were unfaithful to me there. Gilead is a city of the wicked, stained with footprints of blood, and marauders lie in ambush for a man, to do man's decree. A murderer on the road to Shechem, committing shameful crimes. I have seen a horrible thing in the house of Israel. There Ephraim is given to prostitution and Israel to violence. As for you, Judah, a harvest is appointed.
Whenever I would restore the fortunes of my people, whenever I would heal Israel, the sins of Ephraim are exposed in the crimes of Samaria revealed. They practice deceit, thieves break into houses, bandits rob in streets, but they do not realize that I remember all their evil deeds. Their sins involve them, they are always.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, this is similar to a lot of other passages in Hosea, talking about just how hard it is for people to behave themselves for more than a few seconds at a time. And it's a kind of passage that we so often misunderstand because we don't base our understanding of it on God's desire for mercy, not sacrifice. We read into that a harsh, unforgiving condemnation. You guys are snakes. I ought to slap you around. And what's worse is we turn it into a harsh condemnation of other people. Yeah, that's what those people out there are like. Let's slap them around. That's not the point of it. The point of it is that in order to have the mercy on us that God so much wants to have, we've got to understand our need for it. We have to understand how much we need that mercy. God rejoices in giving mercy. God is not all upset and indignant about the fact that we goof up stuff all the time. God simply views it as a way of showing us how much He loves us. God could have created a bunch of robots to do everything perfectly, and He wouldn't have to have mercy. That's not what He wanted. He wants love. He wants a relationship in the truest sense of the word. Not just pals, but a true give and take, a true meaningful interaction, a true acknowledgement of Him and who He is. Robots could not acknowledge God for who He is. Robots might testify to God's skill and intelligence, but that's not what God considers the most important things about His own character. That might be what we think is the most important thing about God's character, but it's not what God thinks is the most important thing about His character. And here again, ecco la cosa. We're not too bad at understanding how powerful God is. Most of us are very clear that God is very wise, He's very powerful, that He knows better than we do. I've known people here in this room who've gone through some horrible experiences and are honestly able to say, I know that God is still in control. I know that God will still take care of things. Some of you have been able to do that in a way that's very powerful testimony to people. So, ecco la cosa. We can do the same thing with God's grace. We can have a pretty good understanding of God's wisdom. That means we can also grasp His grace. It's just that grasping God's grace is a little bit harder to do because we're put off by the fleshly abuses that people make of God's grace. God's grace is a very powerful concept, and we should not back away from it. It is sound doctrine in the truest sense of the word to understand God's grace and God's mercy. Now, what he says here at the beginning of this passage, he says, like Adam, they have broken the covenant. They were unfaithful to me. This is inherent in human nature. And in fact, what does the name Adam mean?
Man.
It means man. So really what he's saying is, they're just like man. That's just like humanity to break my covenant. You're man not in the sense of a male individual, but man in the sense of humanity, mankind, to serve man, expressions of that particular nature. So what he's really saying is they're like man. They're just like human beings, just like I expected when I made them. That's something God went into with His eyes open. He knew it when He created us. It doesn't bother Him. It doesn't upset Him, because it allows Him to show us the extent of His true, genuine love for us instead of showing appreciation for people who had no choice but to do good and to do the right thing. Now, the other thing in this first part of the passage that he talks about is this concept of lying in ambush. And he talks about, and again, this is set in the concept of this war that was causing everyone to suffer. And he's using an example to show you've always had this same nature. This war is just an outbreak of things that were already in your hearts. And he talks about how sad it's been. He mentions going up to Gilead and Shechem. Those were two places of assembly where they would go for their worship assemblies. And it was kind of a notorious thing that when there was time for an assembly or a festival, and these particular festivals were ones that they had just kind of made up. They're not from the Levitical law. But it was kind of notorious that it was time for one of these festivals, gangs of thieves and criminals would lurk along the roads to rob people going on the way to these things. And of course, that's not a good thing. But what Hosea points out is what's even worse than these thieves and these crooks lining the roads and trying to prey on these worshipers is that the priests and the religious leaders are also lurking at the end of the road to exploit them and oppress them and use their positions for their own selfish gain or to boost their own egos. You had these thief-infested roads are a hazard that you knew you had to negotiate if you wanted to go to one of these festivals. It's kind of like if you remember that scene from Casablanca when the Nazis are trying to intimidate Humphrey Bogart with all the great cities of the world that they've invaded and captured. And the head Nazi says to Humphrey Bogart, I bet you'll really be upset when we invade New York, won't you? And Humphrey Bogart says, well, you know, there are some parts of New York City I'd advise you not to try to invade. Well, that's what these roads were like. Really better to avoid them if you can. But what Hosea is pointing out is, as sad as it is that there are these thieves that would actually exploit people's religious desire, it's worse that at the end of these roads there are these priests trying to exploit them religiously, trying to exploit them by taking these people's desire to worship and turning it into an opportunity for these priests either to persuade them to give them money or to boost their egos or to make people feel guilty or to make people feel negatively about God because they are not measuring up to the standard of these priests. That's far worse. That's much worse. You know, there's another movie that may be less well known than Casablanca from the 50s. It's a movie called The Captain's Paradise. It stars Alec Guinness, who people like Phil and Ray know only from being in Star Wars and things like that. But Alec Guinness actually is a terrific actor that did a lot of other things. This particular movie, don't bother renting it because there's no explosions or car chases or anything like that in it. Not even any lightsabers or anything like that. But Alec Guinness plays this ferry boat captain, and his job is once a day, he pilots a ferry boat across the Strait of Gibraltar. Makes one trip a day. So in 2 days, he makes a round trip. So one morning, he'll get up in Gibraltar, take the ferry over to Spanish Morocco, and he'll spend the night there. The next day, he'll get up in Morocco, take the ferry boat over to Gibraltar and spend the night there. Well, the thing of the movie is, this captain has a home and a wife on both ends of his little trip. He's got an English wife in Gibraltar and a Spanish wife in Spanish Morocco. And the English wife is a traditional English woman, very domestic, you know, cooks all the real classic food, and when he goes home to Gibraltar, he goes home and she's there with his slippers and his pipe and everything, and she dotes on him, and he has a nice quiet evening reading his newspaper and having a nice domestic evening with great food and everything, and the wife is mending his clothes and all that kind of stuff. And so he has a great time in Gibraltar, and then his Spanish wife in Morocco, he is very attractive and fun-loving. And so when he spends the night in Morocco, they'll go out and dance and party and have a wild time and everything like that. So he's got the best of both worlds. And the only person that knows about this is his first mate, and his first mate's always kind of heading off the difficulty. And he feels like he's got it great. You know, he's got it exactly the way he wants it. Every adolescent's dream of the women in his life. Well, one night when he comes home in Morocco, his Spanish wife, instead of being ready for a fun night on the town, she got a hold of a cookbook. And she's in the kitchen with flour all over her hair and this apron on and everything like that. And she cooked him up this nice traditional meal. And she's all excited because she's done something for him that he wasn't expecting. And he's upset because that's not what she's for. She is not there for the domestic side of things. She's there to have fun with. And so they have this big argument, and eventually he drags her out and they go to a party, and she doesn't really enjoy it as much as she usually does. And a little while later, he goes home to Gibraltar, and his English wife is waiting for him in this really fancy dress and ready to go out for the night, and she's all excited because she's found a party to go to where there's going to be a lot of dancing and excitement and friends and everything like that. And isn't it going to be a great change for you to get out in the town instead of having these quiet evenings at home? So he's upset with her now, and they have this big argument. And he puts her back in her place, and you're here to cook my food and mend my clothes. You're not here to go out in the town. Well, eventually, these women cannot take being put in the little boxes that he's put them in, and so they both leave it. And if you want to find out what happens after that, you'll have to rent the movie or something like that, even though there are no explosions or lightsaber battles or anything like that. Well, see, the point is, that's human nature, is to want other people to act in such a way as to fulfill our dreams and our expectations, and our ways of what we want out of them. And sadly, we do this even in the church. We view our brothers and sisters either as raw material to be used to fulfill my dreams for what the church ought to be like, or as obstacles to fulfilling my dreams for what the church ought to be like. You know, we all have our fleshly view of what the church ought to be like. Whether your fleshly view of the church is we all come and everybody somberly goes through the rituals that we've been going through for all these decades, if that's what makes you happy, or that it's supposed to be this exciting hoopla and everybody jumping around and making racket and indulging their fleshly desires, or that it's we're running around doing things and counting baptisms and racking up all kind of numbers so that we can feel proud of ourselves. Whatever it is, if you have a view of the church that's based on your desires, then you're going to start viewing your brothers and sisters in terms of whether they fulfill your view of the church or not. You're going to start viewing the ones that don't have the same ideal of the church as annoyances and obstacles, and you'll plot and scheme against them. The ones that have the same idea, you'll overlook the fact that they have flaws and sin in their life too, and you'll start to treat them as if they're somehow superior to these other believers. Well, see, that's what Hosea is criticizing the priests for. As bad as it is that these people have to go through all these thieves just to get to the place of worship, it's worse that the priests are looking at things from the point of view, how can I make use of my position here? How can I get people to do what I want them to do? How can I make people think what I want them to think? And even though we are very, very good at convincing ourselves that our point of view is, in some absolute sense, correct, all that says is how good we are at deceiving ourselves. Because God desires mercy, not sacrifice, and acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. That's the foundation of genuine sound doctrine. It's the foundation of genuine ministry as well. That we have to base everything we do on an awareness that every one of us has an overwhelming need for grace. We have no business judging other people in terms of what they're like or even in terms of how they fit into our ideals for the church. There are plenty of people who you probably think do absolutely nothing in the church. Just pack the pews in the conventional cold-hearted parlance. You don't know that they're not doing something that God appreciates. Probably there are people in our own church who merely by coming here every week, merely by overcoming the pain and the obstacles in their life, are making God extremely pleased. Just the mere fact that they're able to get here and worship with the rest of us instead of giving in to their pain and frustration and doubt and confusion. We just don't know what God wants for other people. We have no business coming up with these fleshly dreams of the church and then shoving other people into our little box and thinking that, well, I've got the view of the church that God really wants. Because we just don't. We just don't know what God wants to do with us. We do know that He desires mercy, not sacrifice. We do know that. We do know that He desires acknowledgement of God rather than the burnt offerings. Now, this other part of the passage emphasizes this from a different perspective because it talks about that they're ignoring His compassion. All the things that these thieves are doing, and you can just imagine the mentality of someone. Oh, yeah, there's a worship service. Let's rob people on the way to it. You can just imagine what a horribly twisted mind that would take. But what Hosea's taking is it takes just as twisted of a mind, people are coming here for worship. Good, how do I get them to do what I think they need to be doing? He's saying that's just as twisted because it's both of them are ignoring God's compassion. Both of them are heartless. Both of them are looking at other people as objects instead of as souls. And so what he talked about here in verse 7, he says, whenever I would heal Israel, the sins of Ephraim are exposed and the crimes of Samaria are revealed. It's God's dilemma. And it, just a minor point up in verse 11 where he says, also for you, Judah, a harvest is appointed. Hosea is a northerner. Hosea lives in Ephraim. And he's kind of making sure because there's this moronic war going on, and again, sorry for the redundancy, but he's making sure not to take sides. He's making sure that the evils that are going on in the country, everybody knows it's not a question of Ephraim versus Judah. It's not even a question of believers versus pagans. It's a question of human nature, like Adam, like man. This is what we're like. We break covenants. We forget God's compassion. We oppress and exploit one another because we're weak. We struggle. Well, God's dilemma, he says, they don't realize that I remember all their evil deeds. I know what's going on. I understand it. They may throw up this pretense about how they've got all these festivals going on and so they must be on the right track, but they forget, I know everything. I'm not blind to what's going on and I don't forget these things that are going on. And again, here's the thing. He's not saying that as a threat. Well, I remember, I see it. He's just saying, look, I know what you guys are like. Don't try to fool me. And if you can manage it, try not to fool yourselves about it either. Try not to pretend that you're something you're not, because I know better. That's all he's saying. Because again, he desires mercy. To appreciate his mercy, we got to honestly accept where we're really at. We got to honestly accept that our actions are just as flawed as everyone else's. Our beliefs are just as flawed as everyone else's. Our tendencies are just as goofy as everyone else's. And so it's God's dilemma. He always knows, he always remembers, but he always wants to have that compassion. Now, there's a little digression here. We do want to read this. There's a little digression where he re-emphasizes, picking up in verse 3, he re-emphasizes the struggle that we have. And he points out that we have a tendency not only to struggle with sin and folly and error, but the real problem is not that we struggle with that, it's that sometimes we actually rejoice in it. And that's what this next passage is about. Jen, could you read verse 3 to 7 of chapter 7? And then Lloyd, could you go with 8 to 10 for us?
By their evil they make the king glad, and the princes by their treachery. They are all adulterers. They are like a heated oven, whose baker ceases to stir the fire, and the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. On the day of our king, the princes become sick with the heat of the wine. He stretches out his hand with mockers. For with hearts like an oven, they approach their intrigue. All night their anger smolders. In the morning it blazes like a flaming fire. All of them are as hot as an oven, and they devour their rulers. All their kings have fallen, and none of them calls upon me.
Ephraim mixes with the nations. Ephraim is a flat pig, not turned over. Foreigners sap his strength, but he does not realize it. His hair is sprinkled with gray, but he does not notice. Israel's arrogance testifies against him, but despite all this, he does not return to the Lord, his God, or search for him.
Here, he has this imagery of an oven, because they're as hot as an oven. They're just inflamed. They're out of control with their sinfulness. And here again, it's not a condemnatory passage. It's just trying to get us to understand. I hope you guys realize how easy it is for you to get out of control. When you forget my grace and compassion, you just get way out of control like this. I forgot to slip this verse in. Norma, could you look up 1 John 2, verse 1? And I'm going to trust you just to read one verse here instead of reading the whole book of 1 John. Because we want to... I know you'll try. Yeah. Could you read that for us? Yeah. 1 John 2, verse 1. Verse 1. Chapter 2. See, she's always trying to slip in these extra verses that she likes.
I don't like it all.
We'll just have you teach the class sometime. It's not going to bother me.
Okay. My dear children, I write this to you that you will not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have one who speaks to the Father in order that
so God explains these things to us so that we won't sin. But if we do sin, what happens? He's got it covered, doesn't he? He's got it covered. Now, I'm well aware that that's easy to abuse. The fact that it's easy to abuse is not a good reason for us not to proclaim it in its full glory. The fact that some people can misuse it is not a reason to ignore it. People can use a baseball bat to crush somebody's skull with. Does that mean we should outlaw baseball bats? No, of course not. People can use grace as an excuse for all kinds of things. It does not mean that we should not proclaim grace to its full extent, because that's what God desires. It's the heart of the gospel. And so what he's saying is, I want you to understand what you really like, because I like it if you didn't sin as much, just because it makes things easier for me. But if you do sin, I got it covered. The problem, as he describes here in chapter 7, is that we tend to get out of control. This imagery of an oven, which actually is unique to Hosea. It's the only place in the Bible where this is used as a kind of an image of a lack of self-control. He's talking about that we sometimes get to delight in our fleshly desire. We not only give in to it, but we just delight in it. We cease to make any attempt to have any self-control. And that's when it becomes a real problem, when we forget about God. And the irony is that it can happen in two ways. Some people fulfill this horrible picture of this fleshly fellowship and this burning fleshly passions. Some people get there because they never think about God at all. They just never cared about God to begin with. But you know, some people get there because they have the wrong view of God, because they view God as a condemner, because maybe we present God as a condemner, maybe because we present God as a perfectionist. And they despair. And they realize, since there's no way to please God, I'm just going to go the other direction. That's how a lot of people end up there, because we fail to teach God's grace. we fail to teach God's mercy. And it's kind of a sad irony that he's describing here. And it's, you know, he says, you know, hey, they delight the king with their wickedness. The king himself is delighted with their wickedness. And so they have this fleshly fellowship that kind of, they reinforce each other in their sin. But you see, the thing is that we can do that even as Christians, because we tend to think of sin, when a preacher gets up and says, there's too much sin in the world today, we associate it with what? The kind of sins pagans commit. You know, homosexuality and crime and using drugs and so forth like that. But there's a lot of other sins beside those things. See, at any given time, certain sins are in. They're hip. They're accepted. And certain sins are not in. But the world just changes its policies on those things, like it's just a fashion. And you see, we tend to get pretty outraged at homosexuals or drug dealers or criminals and things like that, but we tend to kind of, you know, self-righteousness and materialism and judgmental attitudes and things like that, we kind of think, well, you know, there's times when those are justified. You know, we kind of think, oh, that's just never right when someone, you know, these people who want to have make it legal to be homosexuals and legalize drugs and all that, that's just wrong. It's just wrong. God hates it. We need to stamp it out. Well, you know, there's times when you really get really angry at someone. There's times when it's justified to hate someone. You know, they're trying to kill us. We're justified dropping bombs on them, aren't we? And as I pointed out before, it's one of the humorous ironies of our own political environment that there's all these characters out there talking about we need to have limited government that doesn't interfere in people's lives. And they're the same one that want to drop bombs on people. Which, you know, when you drop a bomb on someone, it has a tendency to interfere with their personal life. I don't know if you ever thought about that much. The point that he's making is we got to realize we're all like this. And to God, it's okay. God knew that. It just catch yourself. Don't make the excuses. Don't go down that road. Whether you're going down the road to drug abuse and alcoholism or whether you're going down the road to anger and hatred and Phariseeism, they're both just as dangerous. Maybe Phariseeism can be even more dangerous because it might drive other people away from God. Whereas no one's going to look at some drunk and say, oh, that guy gets drunk. Well, I don't believe in God anymore. They're not going to do that. But somebody who presents God as judgmental and perfectionist, that may have a more negative effect on someone. Verse 8, Ephraim mixes with the nations. He's a flat cake not turned over. He says, Ephraim, my people, they're literally half-baked. Now, he's using it in the image in a different way that we usually use it. He's saying they're half-baked because they're burned and scorched on one side, and they're not done at all on the other side. They've imported the world's mentality, and they haven't acknowledged God's mercy. They see in God only what the world sees in God. They see only the rules side of God, only the do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that side of God. That's all they can see. Well, see, we do the same thing. We import that into the church, the world's mentality. You read every day the news, the popular discussions, those of you who love playing on the internet, all those things, it all centers around something that happens and then everyone jumps all over it. Someone makes a mistake and everyone jumps all over it and shows how righteous they are that they never would have made that mistake. Someone says something foolish and everyone enjoys themselves criticizing and jumping all over it. Because we all want to be, we want to be correct. We want to be right. We want to be on the right side, have the right views. That's just as worldly and just as sinful as any drug abuser or sexually immoral person or anything like that. And this is what Hosea is trying to get us to understand. He says, it's just denying the obvious. It's like an old man whose hair is sprinkled with gray, but he does not notice. Or in some cases, does not notice that his hair has ceased to exist altogether, and he does not want to acknowledge it. And I won't make too obvious pointing out to whom that would apply, but he says, really, all I want is for Israel to return to me. Just search, even if you can't return to me, end of verse 10, just try searching for me. Because if you even just try searching for him, he'll find you. He'll show you where he is. Again, that's all that he wants. Okay, we got that part out of the way. Let's go to the last part of the chapter, because there's some very interesting imagery here where God talks about catching doves. I always like these animal illustrations. Ray, how about if you read verse 11 to 13 for us out of chapter 7? And Angela, have you got your Hosea there handy? Could you read 14 to 16 for us?
I remember like a dove, throw my net to widows, and I pull them down like birds of the air. When I hear them flocking together, I will catch them. Woe to them because they have strayed from me. Destruction to them because they have rebelled against me. I long to redeem them because they keep lying against me.
They do not cry out to me from their heart. And their conduct is a real conduct. Gather together for days and turn away from me. Defend them and keep them out when they cross the line. They do not turn to the Most High. They are like a faulty tower. The leaders will fail, called by their glory, because of their infirmity. For this they will be their strength in the land.
Very good. Thank you very much. He compares Ephraim, Israel, to a dove. Now, when you see the word dove used as an image, what's it usually mean?
Nice
peace. Peace would be the main thing I think that we associate it with. What's another quality of a dove itself that we often think of?
They're harmless.
They're harmless, right? They're innocent, is what they are. And that's the way that he's using it here, is that a dove is completely innocent. It's completely harmless. There's no way in the world a dove can possibly harm you unless some twisted person taught it how to use a firearm or something like that. There's no way it can hurt you. Well, what is he saying in this passage? What's he saying about the innocence of his people? Is it a good thing or a bad thing?
Bad.
Well, the answer to that question is yes.
Yeah.
It is a good thing and a bad thing. Because what he's saying is that this is part of human nature. We're just as easily led and influenced by worldly things as we are by God. We're inherently pretty innocent in a risky way. It's innocence in its true sense, but it's innocence in a risky way. And this is what he's saying. He's saying, guys, I understand why you goof up so much. I understand why you sin so much. You are not inherently evil. You are doves. You are inherently innocent in a true and absolute sense of the word. That means you truly, a lot of times, just don't know better. You truly don't know better than to overcome your lack of self-control. You truly don't know better than to believe somebody when they teach something about me that's wrong. It's all the same thing. This is what he's trying to get across. Look, I know you're doves. I know you're weak. I know you're just as likely to fall into a worldly habit as a godly habit. And he has an imagery that has to do with this war going on. Now you're calling to Egypt, now you're turning to Assyria. That's because in this war that was going on, both the north and the south kept trying to get countries like Egypt and Assyria to come in on their side, instead of just realizing, hey, we're fighting our brothers. Maybe we ought to just stop this and try to settle our differences in an intelligent way. He's just saying, look, I know that's why you're doing it. You're doves. You're foolish. You're just getting dragged along. You got yourselves into this war, and now you can't pull yourselves out. You can't realize that it's wrong. You just got to win it now. Well, you see, that's the way that we get too. We commit ourselves to something, and now we can't admit that it was wrong. We got to harden ourselves. That's how we get to where he described earlier in chapter 7. That's how we lose our self-control. That initial innocence leads us into thinking something that may have seemed good at the time. God doesn't like it when people commit sexual immorality. God doesn't like it when people get drunk and all this. Therefore, God must want me to stamp it out and to pass judgment on these people. So you start with something that's perfectly innocent, and it leads you astray. And then what happens? If you don't catch yourself, you harden yourself. These people did not catch themselves when they merely disliked each other, so they had a war against each other. And then when they had the war against each other, they didn't realize how sad it was for God's own nations to be fighting each other. And instead of backing off, they started enlisting these pagan mercenaries to try to fight for them. We do the same thing in the church. We import worldly methods, little cliques, little plotting, little cabals, ways of judging, ways of making people feel guilty, laying guilt trips on people because they don't meet our expectations of them. It's exactly what he's talking about here. It starts with something very innocent, but it quickly leads to being as hot as an oven. That's what happens. It can easily get out of control if we don't catch it. And what God's saying is, all the time, I'm very happy just to have mercy on the whole thing. We'll just start all over anytime you want. And the thing that he talks about here then at the end of this, he talks about being ridiculed in Egypt because God longs for them. And he even talks about, I'm just going to have to throw my net over them once in a while to restrain them. And if God didn't do that to us once in a while, and you think back to chapter 2 where Hosea did something like that with his wife, if God didn't restrain us once in a while, we'd be completely out of control. We'd completely lose control. It's God's longing for us. But because, he says, verse 14, they don't cry out to me from their hearts. Instead, they wail upon their beds. In other words, instead of just saying, hey, wait a second, God's merciful. Let's just tell him we know we've goofed up and see if he takes us back. Because as he said in chapter 6, as surely as the sun rises, he will. As surely as the sun rises, he's got the mercy waiting. But instead, they're wailing. Oh, this is bad. This is terrible. What are we going to do? Instead of just throwing themselves on God's mercy. And the reason he says they're ridiculed in Egypt is because as a result of ignoring God's guidance and God's perspective, they have become bad examples. What do you think the Assyrians and Egyptians think? Those are God's people and they're fighting it out amongst themselves. You know, the Egyptians had seen many years before. They got a firsthand look at what happens when God rescues his people from oppression and slavery. What do you think they think now? They're getting a good chuckle out of it. And you see, this is the thing he's talking about is we so much worry about the sin out there and the way that those people are apparently angering God and God hates them. We don't think sometimes that very attitude makes God look in a way that he never meant for never meant to be looked. You know, I always like these bird analogies because I'm nutty when it comes to birds. You know, I love to go out and feed ducks and geese, and I love to have conversations with wild animals and stuff like that. And there's the reason for that. Part of the reason is because that's how I came to believe in God. I was raised as an unbeliever. Nature brought me to God. So I still am grateful for that. The other reason why I do that is because I'm nutty. You know, I've been known. Now I make sure when I feed the ducks and geese, I make sure to get something that doesn't have too much sugar or preservatives in it. And I've been known to go out in the middle of winter when it's 5 degrees and this blistering wind, and I'll take my gloves off so that I can tear up little pieces of Italian bread and feed it to them and put it in their little beaks. And you know, when you feed mallards usually can learn to trust people, and they'll come right up to you and very gently take it out of your beak. Canada geese don't do that. Canada geese never trust people because they've met too many people like Lloyd. And so Canada geese, a lot of them will take it out of your hand, but what they'll do is they keep their distance. They got those long necks, and you'll hold it about here, and they'll wait until they think you're not ready to grab them, and then they'll snap it out of your hand. And they don't always aim properly. So I've gotten a lot of nips on my fingers in 5-degree weather because why? Because I'm kind of nutty about animals. I'm kind of nutty about them. I love them. I love to feed them. I love to warn them about people like Lloyd. I love to make their lives a little bit less difficult. As Adrian Monk likes to say, here's the thing. God is just as nutty about us. God is nutty about you. God is as goofy about you, goofier about you than I am about ducks and geese. God wants to know you. He'll do anything. Our trivia question before we go, a little vocabulary trivia. What is the definition of thylacine? Or you can also pronounce it thylacine. And I gave you five. There's five choices and they're all good ones. Who thinks that thylacine means doubling back and then going in a new direction as in a thylacine path? No, the engineers aren't going to take me up on that one. Who thinks thylacine refers to the language or culture of a civilization that once occupied some islands in the Aegean Sea? Don't like that one. Who thinks thylacine means a marsupial carnivore that has been extinct since the 1930s? Got one taker on, two takers on that. Who thinks thylacine is an enzyme that helps the stomach break down complex starch molecules? That's a little more popular, sounds right. Who thinks thylacine is a medication used to treat blood disorders? I actually have a picture to show you. This is a thylacine. It's a marsupial carnivore, very rare creature that very sadly has been extinct since the 1930s. They lived in Australia. They were small creatures, a little bit bigger than a dog. They were considered a nuisance by a lot of farmers and a lot of people who lived in villages. And so the Australian government actually offered a bounty for thylacines if you would kill them. And within about 30 years, they were extinct in the wild. A few of them lived in zoos until the 1930s. And it's even, what's really kind of sad, The last one, the very last thylacine in existence, it's a very sad story. It was in a zoo in Hobart, Australia, and at that time, people didn't care too much about endangered animals. Their deep interest in this last living species of its kind is shown by the fact that they named it Benjamin, and later on they found out it was a female. And they just, 1 week, they just forgot about this poor little thing. And there was a stretch of very bad weather, and after 3 or 4 days, someone realized, oh, we haven't checked on that thylacine lately, and the poor thing was dead. And it's just, it's a sad thing when an animal goes extinct and when people don't care for a little harmless creature like that. And in fact, if you happen to like animals as much as I do, this book is called A Gap in Nature. It's a book about all the animals that have gone extinct strictly by human activity, the animals that human beings have driven extinct. And the title is A Gap in Nature because when an animal is extinct, you can never get it back. Now, 2 points I'd like to make, and if you need to go, I understand, that's fine. 2 points I want to make. You know, there are a lot of people who, fortunately, I think, in most respects, who now speak on behalf of endangered animals and the environment and all the ways that people destroy it. But you know what's sad is a lot of people who do that are just as aggressive and hostile and filled with judgmentalism and hatred as the people they're attacking. You know, if you view nature and the environment as just one more way to feel superior to somebody else, as just one more way to make other people feel guilty, in your own way, you're as bad as the people who pump sewage into rivers and pump filth into the air. It's just the same thing. You're using it for your own selfish interest. The real reason why we should try to preserve nature is because it's a beautiful thing. See, it's just harder to explain that to people. It's a hard sell with people like Lloyd. I try to do it all the time with Lloyd, try to get him to appreciate animals and nature. He has a rudimentary appreciation of it because he loves the fact that there's all these animals because it gives him lots of things to eat. But that's not really what I was trying to get at. But you see, that's the correct reason, that's the real reason why you should get people not to destroy this beautiful world, that after all, where'd it come from? God created it. And unfortunately, sometimes Christians are the most abusive towards the natural environment. But you know what's even more important? I hope that it kind of makes you feel a little sad, this poor thylacine that got left out in the cold by these incompetent zookeepers. But you know what's even sadder? There's a gap in nature when an animal goes extinct that can never be replaced. But there's a gap in God's heart whenever a soul is lost. And we tend to treat souls the same way that those callous zookeepers treated that precious thylacine. They're just there. Some souls are useful to me. Some souls meet my needs, and so I'll treat them with reasonable compassion. But a lot of those souls out there, they're kind of useless. Those people out there that are sinning, God can't have any real interest in their souls, can he? He just wants them to be smacked around and punished. And even some of these people that I go to church with, they're slackers. They don't really do anything like I do. And some of them don't even have the right beliefs like I do. But that's a terribly wrong perspective. That is unsound doctrine, even if you are correct in all the things that you're criticizing them for. It's more important to recognize the value of a soul. God did not create people so that we could just turn them into a numbers game or turn them into fulfilling our own desires like Alec Guinness's character in that movie. It's so that we can appreciate that every soul is precious to God, not to be treated as a number, not to be treated as just a soldier in an army, but to be appreciated because God wants to have mercy and compassion on as many, on everybody. Not just as big of a number as possible, but on everybody. And when a person misses that because we are too judgmental, because we're too quick to try to get them to do what we want to do, it's as cold and callous as those zookeepers who let that poor little thylacine, the last of its kind, die. This is what God wants. And that is the true foundation of sound doctrine and sound ministry. So I'll give you something to think about. Thank you very much for your patient attention.